Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, we'll speak with USDA Chief Economist Justin Benavides about the department's outlook for the upcoming year and discuss what to expect during next week's Farm Bill markup with our panelists. But first, here are this week's headlines. The Agriculture Department's Food Safety Inspection Service is proposing to allow pork and poultry processing plants to increase line speeds. Under the proposed rules, young chicken establishments operating under the new poultry inspection system are allowed to process up to 175 birds per minute. Maximum line speeds for turkey establishments operating under the same rules would increase from 55 to 60 birds per minute. Pork facilities operating under the new swine slaughter inspection system would be allowed to set their own line speeds, as long as they can maintain process controls. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins says the rules would give producers and processors certainty and help keep groceries affordable. The Agriculture Department also issued disaster relief payments for 2023 and 2024 producer losses from drought, flooding, and wildfire. USDA estimates that $1.89 billion has been distributed to producers through the Emergency Livestock Relief Program. The program is separated into two subgroups: ELRP drought and wildfire, which goes to producers that see drought and wildfire-related grazing losses, and ELRP flood and wildfire, which helps cover increased feed costs from floods or wildfires on non-federal land. Both programs have a combined payment limit of $125,000 for each program year. The E15 Rural Domestic Energy Council missed a February 15th deadline to agree on legislation that would allow year-round sales of higher ethanol blends. The ultimate goal for the Congressional Task Force was to have the House consider legislation by the end of this month. The council was set up after an E15 provision was left out of the government funding bill last month. The disagreement is somewhat of a feud between agriculture and many oil refiners. They say any year-round E15 bill needs to reduce the Trump administration's proposed 15 billion gallon ethanol blending mandate for this year and next. And refiners want a protection from an Environmental Protection Agency proposal that would reallocate biofuel credits from small refinery exemptions to other refiners. They say such a policy puts independent refiners in danger of shutting down. Corn and biofuel groups are urging lawmakers not to allow a tiny handful of mid-sized refiners to take year-round E15 hostage while demanding outlandish handouts. The Agriculture Department unveiled their 2026 Ag Outlook this week. We asked USDA's Chief Economist Justin Benavides about the findings.
Yeah, I think the story is making progress this upcoming year. We know that some of the production costs that we've seen spiking over the last few years are beginning to moderate. We are facing steep global competition. That's nothing new. The last few years, that competition has been there. But there are some changes to demand on the horizon that we're beginning to look for. If you want to think about what changes price in the long run, it's changes in supply or changes in demand. And if we think about new innovative sources of demand like biofuel expansion, or we think about increased trade access to other markets, those are the kinds of demand that the administration is working on at this moment, had a few successes. And as we grow demand, that is something that could lift price here in the next year.
And lots of pressures on producers right now. You mentioned some of the optimism in trade, but kind of as you look across the broad farm economy, where do you see other signs of optimism?
Yeah, when we think about, obviously everyone talks about the price of beef, which I think is an incredible story for the demand for the product. We've had 20 years of investment in growing the demand for beef. We obviously are on the downside of the herd size cycle, which increases price because of a little bit of low supply. But optimism in the cow-calf market at the moment is obviously something we've been talking about for several years now. Record-breaking fed cattle prices, record-breaking feeder calf prices. That's been a source of optimism for the last 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, beef prices, though, on the consumer side have been a big concern for this administration. And when do you expect those to begin coming down?
Sure. It's a part of the biological cycle of raising beef cattle. It takes several years to produce a new cow who is ready to have a calf. It takes 2 years for that calf to become beef. So as we see that cycle begin to turn, we did have lower cow inventory this year, but it was the smallest change in a few years. So we could begin to start seeing the turn in the size of the herd, I think as early as the July cattle report, or potentially then the January cattle report. And again, though prices are a little bit higher than they've been historically, I think that is a story of huge demand and positive demand for a very high value product. Of course, you know, talking about beef.
Yeah. Beef has been, you know, one of the few bright spots in the farm economy. But as you look across the rest of the sectors, you know, I would say, which sectors are you maybe most worried about?
We still have some headwinds in the row crop space. If, you know, thinking back to the presentation, we've been in a bit of a divergence between cost of production and price received for really 15 years now. And there's been a few black swans that have masked those influences. We think about COVID, we think about expansion of trade into China, we think about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Those things hit the supply chain in a way that increased demand, and a bit of, again, black swan event. But over time, as competition has grown and we've produced a lot globally in the row crop sector, that competition has put pressure downward on domestic prices. And so we're still facing some of those same headwinds, but that goes back to, you know, the big questions for the year are going to be what happens with the RFS, what happens with rules like 45Z that have the potential to increase demand for some of our products here domestically and raise price.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
As a cooperative, our customers are our owners. They share our profits and help guide our business. We're not just another lender. We're Farm Credit, and we're here for you.
Think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This is my sustainability story.
Welcome back. USDA unveiled its annual economic and trade outlook this week. We asked USDA Chief Economist Justin Benavides how he expects farmers to respond to these market conditions when it comes to making planting decisions this spring.
Yeah, we think back to, you know, as former extension educator, I think it is about sitting down, developing a plan. It's not something that everyone likes to talk about as an all-time solution, but having a plan for your production, knowing your cost of production, making sure that you're targeting break-even prices and marketing effectively throughout the year. There are some pricing opportunities that appear out of nowhere, and when you're ready and prepared to market at the appropriate times, we still know that there are opportunities to at least get some share of your commodity marketed at a profitable level. If we have the opportunity to trade in a weather event, a news event, an announcement of something that might come in the biofuel space, I think it's about having a plan. I think it's about knowing your cost of production and being able to adjust those things in real time as the market changes. If you don't have a plan, it's hard to adjust a plan to react to market conditions.
Yeah, and in your presentation, you mentioned concerns about long-term demand for farm commodities. How are the trends that we're seeing now with use of weight loss drugs and, you know, bigger protein consumption going to impact farmers into the future?
That's a question we talked about briefly during my presentation. I don't think that the research on weight loss drugs, GLP-1s, has come to fruition to a point that we can comment on exactly what the influence will be long run. You know, I had a slide that showed units of snack food sales haven't actually declined at a rate similar to the, or in opposite of the weight loss drug expansion. But that's gonna be something that we watch over the near term in terms of demand for all food products. But on the protein consumption side, both domestically, there's that trend towards high protein products, which is supportive of both our traditional livestock products, meat, poultry, pork, but also thinking about, you know, a supportive demand source for dairy. Think about whey protein and all that kind of stuff that goes into high protein beverages. It's very supportive. And then globally, obviously, as incomes increase, the demand for protein increases. And that's supportive for both livestock prices, but also the feed grain inputs that feed those livestock.
Yeah. And when we look at farm income, it's been really heavily supported by government support payments for several years now, including ad hoc assistance payments. You know, how long is the government going to need to keep making these payments as we look to the future?
Length of time is a hard question to answer. The ad hoc support we typically think in economics was a little bit in response to no investment in the farm safety net since roughly 2002. I think the intent of the One Big Beautiful Bill and the investments in the farm safety net last year were to be able to mitigate the need for further ad hoc support. When you have a well-designed, responsive farm safety net that can adapt to increasing costs of production and changing market conditions, there's a smaller need for ad hoc support. And we'll begin to see the first investments come to fruition this fall as ARC and PLC distribute their first payments under the new payment formulas. So that's that first step out of the cycle of ad hoc, or as the secretary likes to put it, off the hamster wheel of ad hoc support.
Yeah, and you mentioned Secretary Rollins has said, you know, getting off that hamster wheel, but, you know, ag policy experts have said that there really needs to be some greater structural ag policy reforms for less reliance on these payments. You know, what does that take and how long could that take until, you know, farmers are really weaned off of those?
I think it goes back to our discussion about demand, right? We need increased access to markets internationally and we need innovative new demand sources. It all just looks at we have an imbalance between supply and demand at the moment. We need to increase our demand for the products that we produce here in the United States. And the faster we work on growing that demand, the faster we will see price increase.
We'll be back with more newsmakers. But first, Andrew Honecke looks at ag export market competition between Brazil and the United States in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Competition between the U.S. and Brazil in agricultural export markets is growing due to higher output in Brazil and the expansion of productive land. This chart shows the average yields of corn and soybeans from 2020 to 2024 for a farm in Iowa, the state of Mato Grosso, which continues to see rapid expansion of both corn and soybean acreage, and Buenos Aires, Argentina. You can see the U.S. still holds a larger edge when it comes to productivity for metric tons per hectare on corn, but things are much closer when you look at soybeans. Brazilian corn yields are still quite far behind the U.S., in part because farmers prioritize the higher-value soybeans. But that gap is closing. Recent trade tension between the U.S. and China paved the way for record soybean exports for Brazil. Early estimates suggest Brazil shipped almost 109 million tons globally, with 85 million going to China. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Honecke.
Don't miss the must-attend ag policy event of the year. Register now for the 2026 AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit. Hear directly from the leaders shaping the future of agriculture as they explore innovative ideas to strengthen rural economies and guide policy decisions for the year ahead and beyond. The summit takes place March 23rd at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., with a virtual option available. View the agenda and register today at agripulse.com under the Events tab.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south and it blew that way and it went straight down the house. Lost all of our sheep literally a week before we were to start lambing. And I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this farm state of mind piece of paper. And I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Welcome back. The House Ag Committee has released a long-awaited Farm Bill text. We're joined by Tara Smith with Tory Advisory Group and Laura Wood with LWP Consulting on our panel this week. To begin, Tara, can you share what stood out to you in the Farm Bill text?
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly what stood out most is that there weren't a lot of changes from what we saw in 2024, aside from obviously the things that got picked up in OB3. So I think we saw a lot of similarities to what we've seen in the past. And so a lot of consistency there. So I suspect that means we will also see some consistency in the amendments that we'll see offered next week.
And Laura, I want to get your thoughts. You know, what stood out to you in the Farm Bill text? There's also a few, I guess, poison pills, you could say, a provision for California's Proposition 12 and pesticide labeling as well.
Yeah, I think what stands out to me is not what's in this bill, it's what's not in this bill. Yes, the poison pills are being quoted, but I think those can be worked through. I actually think, is it Groundhog Day? Is it Groundhog Day? It's February. I mean, I just feel like it's Groundhog Day. We know the politics of this. We know we have a couple vote margin in both chambers. We saw what happened in 2014 when we split the bills. We saw the floor votes in 2018 when the bill had to come back a month later. because it fails on the floor. So we know conference reports for farm bills pass in large margins. And so it just feels like Groundhog Day, kind of with the partisan nature of poison pill comments slash partisan drafts being put out. But what I say, what I think, what is not in here is really important is that ad hoc aid isn't really addressed. And when your must-pass issue for your, you know, I think bicameral bipartisan committees isn't in your must-pass bill, is it a must-pass bill? And on the same weekend the language dropped, the Wall Street Journal ran a big story on a fifth-generation Illinois farmer highlighting that our farm bankruptcies are up 46% since last year. And this headline and the farm bill texts were unrelated stories. So some of the bigger levers outside of the farm bill have been all this ad hoc assistance over the years, past 6 years. And then, of course, maybe some policy levers in 45Z and this push with E15 that we'll see what happens. But a lot not in this bill.
Yeah. And Laura, when you mentioned kind of that ad hoc additional funding, you know, when could that even potentially come into play? We're not seeing it in the farm bill, but, you know, there's not really another must pass spending bill until very much later this year.
Absolutely, Lydia. I know farmers are waiting on their payments this month from December even. I've never heard farmers talking about supply management like I've heard now, but it's such a catch-22 with national security is food security. The really tough questions about how dollars are going to flow in kind of a post-World War II era where BRICS is moving on. BRICS is 50% of the global population. We're 4%. And they're coordinating grain reserves, fertilizer access, supply chain issues around us, where we've been the number one exporter for a long time. We have a supply and demand problem that far exceeds ad hoc payments.
Yeah. And Tara, I want to get, you know, your thoughts as well on that. You know, farm groups have been saying, you know, we need these ad hoc payments, but, you know, when could they be coming? And, you know, what happens to the farm economy going into this year if they don't receive those as they're kind of waiting for additional aid?
I don't disagree with Laura. I think we're at a bit of a turning point here on farm policy. We've been spending $14 billion a year on ad hoc disaster assistance since about 2019. I would argue that's pretty untenable in the long term. I think there's a hope that OB3 starts to address some of those issues. But again, with the environment that we're in, the economy that we're in changing so much, I don't think it's necessarily a foregone conclusion that the changes in OB3 are going to be the solution. And so, you know, I think we're starting to hear a lot of folks talk about, you know, down the road, what going back to basics here, what is the whiteboard exercise we need to go through on farm policy? Are we covering the risks that farmers need us to be covering? You know, those really basic questions. And I think at some point we're going to have to address those. I don't know if $14 billion a year on average is a long-term sustainable solution. And quite frankly, it's not a very good solution for farmers either, right? I mean, these farmers, when you do an ad hoc program, chances are you're doing one of two things. You're either designing the program to go to who it needs to, and it's gonna take a year and a half for those funds to get out the door, or you're getting money out the door really, really quickly, which probably means it's not as targeted as it could or should be.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
I think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources. This
is my sustainability story.
America never stops. Thanks to the financial support of Farm Credit, neither do the farmers and ranchers who call her home. Since the beginning, we've been helping rural America show the world what hard work can achieve. But the job is far from over. And as rural America grows further, we'll be there.
Welcome back. Although many of the typical farm bill provisions were included in budget reconciliation last summer, Democrats remain frustrated about how nutrition funding was slashed. We asked Laura Wood with LWP Consulting what she expects Democrats' strategy and pushback to look like during the Farm Bill markup.
I kind of think, given the president's approval rating hovering around 40%, should it drop in the next 6 months, you're going to see the Senate in play, probably pick up 25 House seats. So again, when I say, is it Groundhog Day, do we have next year the same situation we're in where the Democrats' strategy now might recognize what's to come in a way that there's some kind of MAHA Trump Democratic deal that could be put together to address SNAP? I'm not so sure when we have an executive order invoking Korean War Act to promote glyphosate, that's also politically possible. But I do think the strategy is kind of political. And for better or worse, that's really hard to get to the kind of core issues we need for our farm community. And like I said, we're just competing in an environment that is so much more competitive than it used to be.
Yeah. And Terry, I want to get your thoughts as well. Four Democrats, you know, jumped across party lines to vote for the Farm Bill when it passed out of committee in 2024. And I'm curious, do you think there could be similar bipartisanship on this Farm Bill? And do you also, I guess, expect pushback from within the Republican Party from those members more aligned with the Make America Healthy Again movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall we'll probably have some Democrats again who will cross party lines, if you will, who will vote for this Farm Bill, in part because they're facing elections back home. And sometimes they're going to need to have said that they voted for a Farm Bill, that they got something out of that Farm Bill and that they voted for the Farm Bill. And the political dynamics in other districts is going to be the complete opposite. And so I really think we're going to see the election politics hanging over this process. And I know it does feel a little bit like Groundhog Day, but I will say, you know, you can't get a Farm Bill done if you don't start the process. And so I do sort of commend Chairman Thompson and the committee for putting a bill out there, starting the process up again, and starting to move that ball forward, even if the situation isn't ideal. We've gotten ourselves into a bit of a pickle with the Farm Bill process. We used to have this bright red line, not to make myself sound old, but back in the day, the mantra was, once you wrote a Farm Bill, you didn't open the Farm Bill for any reason. Even if it was to add money, even if you thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, the sky really needed to be falling in order to have a reason to open a Farm Bill, but you didn't open that Farm Bill. And I think now we've kind of been reminded why you don't do that mid-cycle. Because when you open up that Farm Bill, even if it's to do something great and add money into conservation programs, if you're doing it in a really political process, it's going to have a domino effect, and that's going to carry forward, and it's gonna make the continuation of Farm Bills more and more difficult.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Hunneke looks at the rising number of Chapter 12 bankruptcies, and this week's Map It Out.
The number of Chapter 12 bankruptcies is on the rise across the country due to the challenging economic times many producers are facing. This map shows the amount of Chapter 12 bankruptcies that were filed by state last year, according to federal court filings. There were 315 bankruptcies filed, which is 46% higher than the year before. Arkansas saw the most with 33, Georgia was second with 27, and Iowa was third with 18. Despite the higher year-to-year numbers, the number of filings remains below those seen from 2008 to 2020. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Hunneke.
Don't miss the must-attend Ag Policy event of the year. Register now for the 2026 AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit. Hear directly from the leaders shaping the future of agriculture as they explore innovative ideas to strengthen rural economies and guide policy decisions for the year ahead and beyond. The summit takes place March 23rd at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., with a virtual option available. View the agenda and register today at agripulse.com under the Events tab.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south and it blew that way and it went straight down the house. Lost all of our sheep literally a week before we start lambing. And I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this Farm State of Mind piece of paper. And I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Both the House and Senate return to session next week, and the House Agriculture Committee will begin marking up the Farm Bill on Monday. Plus, mark your calendars and register for the AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit on March 23rd in Washington and streaming virtually. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.